Your Health is supported by the North Carolina Cancer Hospital, serving you with innovative research and unequaled care. UNC Healthcare is leading, teaching, caring.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by 97.9 The Hill and UNC Family Medicine. Your Health, providing practical health-related news and information for our community. As Drs. Page and Goldstein specialize in patient care at UNC Family Medicine. And now, Your Health on 97.9 The Hill and on demand at chapelboro.com.
Welcome to UNC Family Medicine's Your Health, supported by UNC Healthcare. I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein. I want to welcome back our great guest co-host, Dr. Steve Hooper. Welcome, Steve.
Thank you, Adam. Great to be here.
We have a really interesting guest today, Dr. Luana Coloca, who's going to be talking about the placebo effect and the nocebo effect, how certain actions, words, drugs make us better or make us worse, not by the effect of the drug, but just by the thought process. First, though, we've got some interesting research that matters today. Let's dive right into it. And the first one is discrimination, and in this case, higher sexual assault that trans teens face in schools. What are we talking about?
This is a very important issue in our current society, not only in terms of the discrimination aspects that many people see, but in terms of our policies and how we actually legislate and deal with individuals who are different.
Yeah, in this particular case, this was looking at over 3,600 teens in American middle and high schools and found that more than one in four of these trans and non-binary teens reported being sexually assaulted in the previous 12 months. That alone is frightening. These are teens being assaulted, predominantly sexual and physical assaults, and it was much more likely if they were actually forced to go to the bathrooms where they were their assigned gender at birth versus how they associate. So if the transgender men who identify as male but are labeled female on their birth certificates had to go to the female restroom only, they were more likely to experience sexual assault.
And unfortunately, it is where many of our political policies are leaning in terms of the simplicity of this. And I think this is far more complicated than genitalia.
And transgender girls who identify as female but were assigned male at birth had two times the level of assault when they had to use the restrooms and the locker rooms for boys. You know, these participants were 15 years old on average. And if they had more restrictive policies in the schools, the rate of the assault climbed to 35%. It seems like we can do, and I think we must do better.
Agreed.
Our next research that matters is about parenting. And in this particular case, we don't have to be perfect, perhaps. Which is good for me.
And good for me as well. I'm sure my daughters would agree with that. What's interesting about this, though, is in this article, it is you only have to be right 50% of the time. So those are pretty good odds.
I'm right at least half the time.
That's right.
Well, this is a research that was actually published in the journal Child Development. And it's looking at when young infants were, let's say, having crying episodes, and then how, in this case, the parent and probably more often the mother responded to that infant, and did they respond in a way that really was what we might call the more supportive cooing and, you know, swaddling and holding versus things that could be more scary, raising one's voice, picking up in something more startling. And you would think, oh, if they just do it wrong one time, that's not good, which it may not be, but getting it right, as you said, only half the time actually was protective.
Exactly. And I think another important facet to this study is they work with low-income families. So this is a tool that actually would make accessibility to good parenting available to everyone.
Yeah. I think we'll put this ask our health sciences librarians to put this study up on our website, because I think it's a complex study and I think it's worth looking at. Our next research that matters is about a slightly different issue, but it is about avocados. Do you like avocados?
Love avocados.
I love avocados too. This may actually curb appetite for those who maybe eat sometimes more than they should. Happens to me sometimes.
Absolutely. And this was a pretty sophisticated clinical trial that looked at the use of avocado in a diet. And interestingly, if you like avocado, it actually will be a nice addition to your diet because it not only curbs your diet, but it lets you know that you're full and that you're satisfied.
Yeah, it kind of suppressed the hunger aspect and increased the meal satisfaction. And they did this actually in adults who were overweight and obese. It was published in the journal called Nutrient. And it's actually, they found that there was a hormone called PYY. I think we'll call that pie. And that this was kind of, this hormone kind of regulated this response from avocado. So there's maybe a biological, certainly, response. In any case, eat more avocados.
Bon appetit.
Our last research that matters is one that is near and dear to me and probably all clinicians who've seen young athletes with concussions, which is what makes some athletes either report it, not report it, take it seriously, not take it seriously, and go back into competition more quickly than others.
There are a multitude of issues that go there. This study had 400 Division I football, soccer, basketball, wrestling, lacrosse, and field hockey participants. So these are major college student athletes.
And this was actually published in the journal PLOS One, P-L-O-S One, and really kind of interviewing them and them filling out surveys about, you know, what their perceptions were about what would happen to them if they reported, they didn't report, how likely, how quickly. And I think it showed that there's a real hesitation. It depends on the culture that's probably established and communicated to them about concussions because they think, oh, if something bad happens to me, it's going to happen in the distant future. And I remember once, Steve, I was at a dance performance, American Dance Festival, and there was a young dancer there who I witnessed with a pretty significant fall and hit their head and had a pretty significant concussion, but the dance director wanted them to go right back to competing the next day, or really not competing, but dancing. And I said, no, I really think that's not right, and I really strongly discourage it. But boy, it was swimming uphill.
The other facet here is I think with all states now having concussion laws, especially for our middle school and high school athletes, and football in particular, the fact of the matter is that those laws contain educational requirements. One of the aspects of this study was that they found that not only did the athletes not recall much of the education training they got on concussion, but their coaches weren't involved either and probably not very knowledgeable about it. And quite frankly, those are probably two key people that need to be involved and in the legislation, most legislation, two key players that are noted to be involved.
From your mouth to God's ear, so the saying goes. Well, that'll conclude the Research That Matters portion of our show. We'll take a short break, and when we return, we'll be talking with Dr. Luana Colloca, placebo expert, pain researcher, and associate professor at the University of Maryland, about the real science behind tricks of the mind. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Steve Hooper. Stay with us. UNC Family Medicine's number 2 ranked national program is rapidly transforming healthcare through excellence in teaching, clinical care, and research. To participate in UNC Family Medicine's efforts to move innovative ideas into action, call 919-843-5112 or email yourhealth@unc.edu.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, a presentation of 97.9 The Hill and UNC Family Medicine. And now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Steve Hooper. Today on Conversation, Steve, we're talking with Dr. Luana Colloca, placebo expert, pain researcher, and associate professor at the University of Maryland about the real science behind tricks of the mind. Welcome to Your Health, Dr. Colloca.
Thank you very much for having me.
This is such a great opportunity for us to have this conversation today, which really is about everything we do in healthcare, our words, our procedures, our testing. And before we get into the topic, can you tell us, how did you become a physician and a scientist and a researcher?
Well, my goal originally was to be a physician, and I had an interest in neurology and neurosurgery. The brain was the most fascinating organ while I was studying medicine. And eventually, I started practicing for a little bit, and I realized that my interest is in learning and discovering new things. And I decided to go back to school and start a PhD in neuroscience to learn more about brain functions. Eventually, I was totally impressed by the amount of things that we still needed to know about the brain, and I was lucky to start this PhD in neuroscience with Fabrizio Benedetti, and at that point we were studying placebo effects in Parkinson's patients into the intraoperative room. So I was very much in line with my interest to discover brain mechanism, to study neurons and placebo effects. I was very skeptical about placebo. I told my boss, listen, I'm not a psychologist, I wanted to do medicine and research that has an impact for patients' lives. And I discovered soon that actually placebo effects as well as nocebo effects can be quite relevant in medicine. And when we started to do this research in patients with Parkinson's disorders, the setting was unique, intraoperative neurophysiology, recording from single neurons, observing how the discharge and the activity of single neurons may change as a result of patient expectations was a revelation, an epiphany. I decided that this was my area of research, and in the beauty of this model that somehow is a tool to learn about brain functions, but also, as we know, there are many translational and ethical implications for daily medicine, as you mentioned. So I turn into a scientist, and my background in medicine is helpful. Every day, from mentoring MD student and the nursing student, but also to learn more and inform my research.
So you had a very interesting pathway to get where you are. Tell our listeners a little bit about the placebo effect. What is it? What do we know about it? And tell us a little bit about how your passion for it has driven your research.
Well, every time we use or we prescribe any treatment, we have an expectation as people, as patients, and as physicians. And this kind of expectation can be both positive or negative. Negative expectation drive what we call a nocebo effect, and positive expectation are relevant to create benefit and outcomes. But until we maintain this kind of topic at the level of behavioral outcomes and clinical outcomes, we know that there are many chances that we are looking at biases and not, something more than noise. So the goal is to try to understand if when we observe an improvement, let's say a patient take a placebo or an active treatment and experience a huge benefit, this kind of changes occur not in a vacuum, rather there are changes in the brain and a set of mechanisms that can make these symptoms feel better. So the goal is to try to understand what is a noise and what is a real placebo effect. And to do that, we have to use sophisticated techniques as well as elegant methodological design that allow us to separate confounding factors that can be, for example, biases or remission or natural history. I mean, many times, for example, when we talk about pain, we can observe an improvement of pain because the disease or the symptom can get better independently of a neurobiological change occurring in the brain. So the goal is to try to understand the difference between what it can be noise and biases and rather a neurobiological change occurring in the mind and in the body.
You know, what's interesting is if one thinks about the goal of research, and Steve and I do research and we're active clinicians, is to eliminate the placebo effect. We want to really minimize it in a research setting. We want to be able to see, does our test treatment work? And if the placebo is really high, it sometimes is hard to see that.
It'll confound the results.
But in a clinical realm, I want to maximize my impact. I want to use every tool that I have. Is there a conflict between these two goals?
I'm glad that you're asking this, because for a long time we kept research and clinical practice as two distinct fields. Like, okay, neuroscientists, the scientists will learn about the neurobiology of placebo and nocebo effects, but clinicians eventually will use that and this sort of art of medicine. What we try to do today, use the mechanism of placebo and nocebo effects to inform clinical practice. It is true, in a context that can be, for example, a clinical trial, we may want to eliminate completely placebo and nocebo effects to optimize our ability to discover new therapeutic treatments. But when it comes to clinical practice, leveraging all this mechanism about placebo and nocebo can be helpful to bring a new insight into daily clinical practice. Eventually, we can optimize doctor-patient relationship, clinician communication, and why not use sometime a placebo to potentiate a benefit. But also without any use of sugar pills, talc pills, we can still harness placebo effects merely by using what we call framing effects. The way we disclose benefit or side effects to patients can make a difference. So on one side, we want to minimize when we study new treatment in the context of clinical trials. On the other hand, in clinical practice, we want to enhance placebo effect to benefit patients. And in the middle, we have what we call translational research that try to bring together the mechanistic approach, the brain functions that we know change under, you know, the placebo and nocebo effect to optimize and guide clinical practice.
With these findings or these observations, it almost sounds like, and correct me if I'm wrong, that a placebo effect could have an evidence base.
Absolutely, that is the goal. What I think that is the revolution of the last three decades. Placebo and nocebo effects have been investigated as neurobiological phenomena. That means the goal is to try to understand how we can translate this mechanism to improve medicine. And I can provide some example. We are designing clinical trials in a different way, from basic things like assessing expectancy before starting a trial or assessing allocation thoughts in participants in clinical trials to, you know, identify biomarkers. And in this case, we can talk about neuroimaging as well as omic biomarkers, where eventually we can, improve our personalized approach to pain management and medicine in general by discovering which kind of patient may be more, resilient to pain, for example, and other symptoms, as compared to other patients that can be more vulnerable. There are individuals that can have very beautiful therapeutic interventions and responses, even with, inert substances. And the reason is eventually because they are able to activate what we call the endogenous pharmacy. So this sort of endogenous self-healing pharmacy is based on the release of endogenous opioids and other substances in the brain. So the goal is to try to understand why some people are able to do that and feel better as a result of these endogenous mechanisms, as compared to other people that eventually are those who tend to be also more difficult to be treated with conventional and standard approaches. So the ability to understand somehow why some people can benefit from endogenous mechanism of healing as compared to some other people that tend to be less resilient can make a difference in the approach we use when we treat different symptoms. And this approach eventually can help us to avoid, for example, opioids misuse. We are dealing with the epidemic of opioids. I mean, try to understand how the release of endogenous substances that mimic exogenous opioids can be relevant and eventually help us do not treat all patients with the same standard approach, but tailor the administration of painkillers to each single patient needs.
This is interesting, and we're going to continue this, but we need to take a short break. When we return, we'll continue talking with Dr. Luana Coloca, placebo expert, pain research, and associate professor at the University of Maryland about the real science behind tricks of the mind. We'll be right back with Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein, Dr. Steve Hooper. Stay with us.
Your Health is supported by UNC Health Sciences Library and NC Health Info, working together to connect people everywhere with knowledge to improve health. Visit nchealthinfo.org for answers you can trust.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, a presentation of 97.9 The Hill and UNC Family Medicine. And now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back. You're listening to Your Health, and we've been talking with Dr. Liana Koloka, placebo expert, pain researcher, and associate professor at the University of Maryland, about the real science around placebos and nocebos, N-O-C-E-B-O. And right before the break, Dr. Koloka, you were talking about some of the real science behind it. And I want to pivot slightly to talk about some of the ethics. I know that in times past, doctors would give things like B12 shots, knowing that they really didn't do anything to most patients to hurt them, but perhaps they felt they helped them. I think today we would say that's probably not ethical. Are all placebos, if you are using them, unethical, or can some be ethical and some be unethical?
Well, I would say that still physicians prescribe treatment like antibiotics, vitamins, antidepressants when there is no indication or they hope that there will be an answer. So somehow this practice of prescribing placebo, and some people call inert placebo, though, you know, this can be a source of debate, still surveys of clinicians and physicians tell us that this is something happening today in 2019. Why do we do that? We have some situations that clinically not necessarily have the best treatment to be prescribed. A physician may tend to prescribe a treatment. And from an ethical perspective, the intention can be good. I mean, giving a treatment to benefit a patient. I'm not totally on board with this idea. I tend to be a little bit more on, you know, the practice based on evidence. I would rather prefer an educational tool where instead of prescribing an antidepressant when there is no indication or an opioid when there is no indication, I would sit with the patient and explain. And the same way we explain, for example, to a patient with cardiological problem that the valve eventually doesn't close well, we can explain also some symptoms that are related on functions that depend on the brain, for example, a change in mood or change in pain, and explain that there are mechanisms to cope, and eventually there is this possibility to work together, clinician and patient, to improve outcomes. So rather than prescribe treatment that per se may not have indication, I would prefer, you know, communication style where patients are transparently informed. Like, there is no indication that, you know, this treatment is the best one for your symptom or for your disease. We may try, but this may evoke merely a placebo response. And eventually the patient will ask, what is a placebo response? What are you telling me? And we can explain that merely taking a treatment that can be an inert substance, a sugar pill, can trigger a set of mechanisms in the brain that make him or her feel better. So as long as there is this transparent conversation with the patient, no deception, I'm fine with prescribing something that can be used as a placebo.
So that's a true transparency. An extension to Adam's question on the ethics, do you find, you mentioned pain here a few seconds ago, but are there situations that would warrant consideration of use of placebo versus others that would not?
Yes, we know that there are some conditions that tend to respond to placebo much better than others. And an example can be, you don't prescribe placebo for severe psychiatric problems or we know that some kind of pain, for example, musculoskeletal rather than neuropathic pain, respond to placebo better than other disorders. The severity of the disease is also important. You don't prescribe placebo for severe and life-threatening situations. So, in general, placebo tend to function much better in moderately non-severe conditions. But also there are a set of disease that do not change at all with a placebo. Let's assume a cancer, if we want an extreme example. Cancer can't be cure with placebos, but you can treat the fatigue, you can treat the pain, so some other symptoms like nausea or anxiety, but definitely we need to be careful, do not use placebo in a situation where we have active treatment that need to be used.
You know,
we don't need the per se placebo, I mean we can evoke placebo effects without any placebo. So the way we disclosure, the way we communicate with patients, the way we take care of the context can per se produce a placebo effect.
You know, I was thinking about a nocebo too, and I was thinking about an example. I had a patient come in and tell me once that they had a bleed in their eye, and they went to see an eye doctor, and the eye doctor came in for about 10 seconds and said, "You've had a bleed in your eye. There's nothing we can do. You'll never get better." And kind of walked out. And this is how the patient related to me. And they were so despondent. And I often thought it wasn't necessarily what was said, but how it was said, and that the words themselves actually caused harm. What are some of the other examples of nocebos that you research?
Nocebo effects are much more strong and common than placebo effects. Definitely, a verbal suggestion like this situation with this eye problem, bleeding, and the way the physician communicates to this patient can be detrimental. And we know that nocebo effects can be evoked without any treatment, merely by informing patients. And unfortunately, there isn't too much awareness of this phenomenon, and still, as clinicians, we feel entailed to say all the truth, and we don't pay too much attention to balance truthful information and somehow, minimize adverse events and side effects that are resulting from the verbal suggestions, the way we inform a patient, as well as, the attitude, or even, when we inform a patient about severe side effects as well as prognosis, how much they may live and so on. This can be much more common than placebo effects. We demonstrate in the lab that people who do not have any painful stimulation delivered to them, if we tell them this electrical stimulation is going to be harmful, you will feel pain, they start to feel just perceptible electrical stimulations as painful. But also, there are many examples of other nocebo effects. From cancer again, we know that many patients start to feel nausea, and merely when they enter into the room where they receive the treatment. And this is an example of nocebo effects related to the conditioning and context. But mostly, verbal suggestion seems to be one of the most powerful way to induce nocebo effects, and this is what we daily tell our patients. For example, if we inform them you are not going to respond to this treatment or this intervention may not be good for you, we set expectations that can make a difference in their life, and unfortunately, very often, this is a path to side effects and nocebo effects.
Wow, so words do matter and contribute to potentially biologic changes that are endure for our patients.
Again, biological, I like that you mentioned that because there are several brain imaging and neurobiological approach show that, when we expect something to be negative, there is this strong anticipation of negative outcomes in the brain that can activate specific circuits and, for example, for pain, facilitate nociception. That means we can feel stimulations or, clinical pain that per se would not be so high as higher. And this is because we activate a set of mechanisms in the brain that involve the region from the rostral anterior cingulate cortex to the periaqueductal gray and in general up to the spinal cord that can amplify the nociceptive signaling.
So as we wrap up in the next minute, as a researcher, what would you like to see moving forward, next steps in research on this topic?
I think it is very critical to continue with the genetic approach, because somehow if we can anticipate those patients who can benefit from this inner pharmacy, self-healing processes, we can optimize therapeutic management of symptoms. But also it is important to understand how, you know, a nocebo effect can impact clinical outcomes. And we need a switch in the way we educate clinicians, physicians, because so far we consider this merely an ethical issue. You know, from an ontological perspective, we educate future physicians to discuss difficult situations with their patients. But if we started to think about this phenomenon at the level of neurobiological changes, probably the impact that our world and the meaning of our world, the way we convey information, may have a different impact in the curricula and the education of future clinicians, so that we can minimize unintended side effects related to nocebo and negative expectations. Another important step will be optimization of clinical trials. Again, before we start telling that there is a sort of separation between clinical practice and research, there is also a sort of separation between clinical trial research and laboratory research, where people come in my lab, in many other labs, and we do experiments. It is a little different than drug development. So again, we need to create a bridge between these two areas, clinical trial research as well as laboratory research, so that the mechanistic knowledge can inform future design of clinical trials and help the development of drugs.
You are doing fascinating work, and I am very impressed about the neurobiologic components of placebo and nocebo, and I thank you. We've been talking with Dr. Luana Coloca, placebo expert, pain researcher, and associate professor at the University of Maryland, about the real science behind tricks of the mind, and it really does seem like we have science there. And again, thank you, Dr. Coloca.
Thank you, Adam and Steve.
Coming up on House Calls, we'll be answering questions about your health. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Stephen Hooper. We'll be back.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, a presentation of 97.9 The Hill and UNC Family Medicine. And now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back to Your Health. For the House Call segment of our show today, we're going to spend a few minutes talking about your health questions and concerns. If a listener has a question they'd like us to address on an upcoming show, they can send comments to yourhealth@unc.edu. We'd like to ask our executive producer, Laura Lacey, to read us our very first House Call question.
My mother is now 80 and has had severe arthritis of her back. Over the past 3 months, I've noticed that she's not able to stand up straight anymore, and she seems to have pain constantly. Who should we see, and do you have any thoughts about what might be done for her?
Well, Steve, I'm certain in your field and the Division of Allied Health that you got a lot of clinicians that see a lot of people with arthritis.
Indeed. And in fact, one of the discussions this individual should have with their primary care provider is the possible need to see a physical therapist or even perhaps an occupational therapist, not so much to work on the little muscles perhaps, but in terms of the mobility and moving around the environment, and are there environmental changes along with whatever physical manipulation might need to occur.
Yeah, I know that for the most part, primary care physicians don't know so much about adaptive ways of walking or support mechanisms that can help, what braces may or may not help, what adaptive devices may or may not help. But the physical therapist and occupational therapist do know these things.
Indeed. That's exactly what they would be helpful for. And they'd be able to help this individual make adjustments to the use of those adaptive devices if indeed they're needed.
Sometimes a physiatrist, a physical medicine rehab specialist can also play a role here. I hope you get better. Thanks so much for that question. I know it's difficult. Laura, what's our very next house call?
I'm 75, and I've had debilitating cirrhosis for several years. Unfortunately, I got turned down for disability the first two times I applied. Each time, they said I could still do a desk job, even though I can barely stand for 2 hours at a time. Finally, my doctor wrote a note saying to the disability judge that it was malpractice if they didn't put me on disability. The judge agreed with the doctor, but then said they would not give me any retroactive compensation. I just wanted to share.
This kind of makes me want to hit my head on the desk.
Yeah, the bureaucratic aspects of this can be enormously frustrating.
You know, we look at a disease like cirrhosis or hepatitis C, sometimes it can cause cirrhosis, and you look and you see, you know, a lot of times you don't see how bad people feel on a day-to-day basis because they're so fatigued from the liver not working. And until the liver gets like to the last 10%, they may not actually have the physical manifestations that people could see, but they can report they can barely function.
And the cognitive fatigue that goes with all of that.
Right. We're glad you got the disability finally, and sorry that it didn't occur earlier. We certainly know how that physician and provider might have felt frustrated, but luckily you had a physician or provider that actually stood up for you. That alone is worth its weight in gold. Laura, what's our very next house call?
My sister has really bad OCD, so bad, in fact, that she won't even go to the doctor many times because she's scared of encountering germs there. What kind of options exist for her?
OCD, obsessive compulsive disorder, can manifest in so many different ways. One of which ones I've seen a lot is people who really obsess about germs, and they'll wash their hands dozens of times a day, or maybe they'll put on gloves every hour, a new set of latex gloves.
And they'll avoid situations such as this individual, even going to the doctors.
Right. You know, this is something that I would have a conversation with the doctor about. You know, if we can get the patient in the room, you know, maybe there's some accommodations that can be made. You know, maybe the doctor can say, listen, I know that you don't like being touched because of the fear of germs. You know, maybe we can do a lot of the examination without actually touching. Maybe we can do some of the examination, you know, put a paper towel, you know, between the stethoscope and your skin. Maybe make sure that doctor's wearing gloves. Things that could help alleviate and show you have some respect, because those things are difficult. There may be some medications and some behavioral therapies too.
Absolutely. Getting potential medications may be very helpful.
Right. I think having a relationship is probably one of the keys that will be helpful. Laura, what's our very last house call?
I went with my father to see his doctor because he was worried about being tired despite being in good health. He recently retired and our mother's been pretty ill. The doctor asked my dad to fill out a form. He looked at the form and said my dad was depressed. We were both really surprised, but in retrospect, it does make sense. Do doctors usually use this type of form?
Yeah, I'm really glad to hear this doctor, that clinic, used a form that helps diagnose depression, because it'd be really easy in a 70-year-old man to miss a diagnosis of depression when it's just coming on with some fatigue.
Absolutely. The other part of that is many of these types of screening tools are now required as part of care in any clinic. And in addition to that, these are screening tools. So in many instances, a diagnosis can be put forth, but also it may also be an indication for further evaluation and treatment for depression.
You know, in this particular case, we would hope that either combination of medication, therapy, discussion, self-help, activating some channels called early enough could really be helpful.
Yeah.
Well, that's going to conclude House Calls, and we thank you all for joining us today for your health. We hope we've addressed issues and concerns important to you. You can share any questions by emailing us at yourhealth@unc.edu. You can visit us online at yourhealthradio.org or follow us on Twitter, Facebook, iTunes, or our health app. I'd like to thank the UNC Department of Family Medicine and UNC Healthcare for their sponsorship. Our guest today, Dr. Luana Coloca, and guest co-host today, Dr. Steve Hooper. We hope you join us next time on Your Health. On behalf of Your Health, I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein.
And I'm Dr. Stephen Hooper.
And we'll look forward to talking to you again next week. Take care.
The purpose of Your Health Radio is to educate listeners on healthcare issues. Listeners should always discuss their own health or medical concerns with their personal physician or other healthcare provider. Your Health is not a substitute for medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment.
You've been listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on 97.9 The Hill, presented by UNC Family Medicine. You can find this or any other episode of Your Health on demand at chapelboro.com. Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on 97.9 The Hill, your community radio station.